Hey, insiders. Here's a bonus part of the conversation between Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. And as always, please write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com.
Why don't we turn, as we said, to some of the other issues that are still bubbling out there, though it's hard to keep a focus on them with the coronavirus. But starting with FISA, very briefly, as we discussed in our last broadcast, there was an Inspector General report that found serious flaws in the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Order, allowing the electronic surveillance of Carter Page. That stirred up quite a controversy, political, and then also just sort of a good bit of self-examination by the FBI as to how that happened. Then there was a more recent report from the Inspector General that found other issues in the FISA process. You want to walk through them?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think the initial review that the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, did of the Carter Page FISA, or FISAs, because they got renewed several times, that then spawned a broader look, right? So Horowitz undertook a broader review of how the FBI has been handling the FISA process, and in particular, something called the Woods procedures. Maybe you should go into a little bit, Ken, about what the Woods procedure is, because that's really what Horowitz looked at.
Yeah, and that, I'm glad you turned over the national security nerd question to me, the resident national security nerd.
Well, you know, since it goes back many, many years, I figure, you know.
I'm probably to blame for the problem, right?
Well, it was something that came about in the Pleistocene era, I think. So maybe you should, right. You're closer to that.
I was running around avoiding T-Rexes.
Yeah.
So look, the Woods procedures, once again, this is FISA wonkishness, but there's a problem in any process by which law enforcement or the intelligence community gets a judge to provide, to allow them to do any kind of search or seizure. So you have issues where an agent or a police officer fills out an affidavit in support of a search warrant for a house in a drug case. Well, you know, how accurate is that search warrant? It's based on that agent's or that officer's perception of facts. And so there's always room to go back and second guess the accuracy of those orders. That is the same situation when it comes to FISA applications. But it's even a more serious concern in some ways, because unlike search warrants in regular criminal cases, or even wiretap orders in regular criminal cases, FISA applications and orders don't get released. The target is never notified, unless he or she happens to be prosecuted ultimately, never notified that there was a FISA. Most FISA applications aren't scrutinized by a judge like a lot of criminal warrant and warrant applications are. So that puts a premium on making sure that those applications that the judges look at, the judges in the FISA court look at to decide whether or not to issue a surveillance order, it puts a premium on making sure those applications and statements of fact are absolutely accurate. And there was a problem back in, I think, around 2000, where the FISA court felt like there was inconsistency and confusion in the process that generated the FISA applications, and they were concerned about accuracy. And they wanted to make sure that there was a process in place in the FBI that they had evidence and they had records to support every factual contention that was put in an affidavit in support of a FISA order. One of the practical reasons why this is a problem is, you know, FISA applications are put into the FISA court here in Washington, D.C., but the investigations are run all over the country, all over the world. And so the person, the agent who might know the facts might be in Oshkosh or in L.A. or in Phoenix, not here in D.C. And so sometimes things are lost in translation or garbled. And as a result, you had these mistakes. The FISA court ordered that there be procedures in place that required that the FBI would have a file that would say, as to each of these factual contentions in the FISA application, there is this support for that contention. And Michael Horowitz, after he discovered the problems with the Carter Page FISA, went back and looked at a number of FISA applications, and I want to say it was in the 25 range, and found that there are violations of the Woods procedures. There were files missing. There were factual contentions not supported in pretty much every one of the FISAs that he reviewed, which has suggested to people that there might be a more chronic problem with the FISA process than the missteps that were found underlying the Carter Page FISA.
Can we pause for a second and ask, like, why are they called the Woods procedures?
Michael Woods was the FBI general counsel lawyer who actually wrote up the procedures and who got them put in place. And he did that back in, I think, 2000. So, and they've been in place since then.
Right. They take on a life of their own. And he's now the grandfather, as it were, of these procedures. But, you know, it's a really good point that they were created to address problems that you talked about, Ken, around the 2000-2001 timeframe. And one of the things that the Horowitz report, I think, points up, and some other commentary around this, like from our former colleague and friend David Criss has written about, is that the culture of the FBI and the Justice Department has evolved over time. And the people who were adhering to these things called the Woods procedures, you know, were not even in the FBI in many respects, in many instances probably, when these procedures first came about. So is there a need to kind of refresh and reemphasize why there needs to be such strenuous adherence to accuracy? So, you know, I think this report by Horowitz about these broader concerns and the failure to adhere scrupulously to documenting the factual support for every assertion in FISA applications, it's already spawning a lot of reforms and changes by the FBI and by our old division, the National Security Division. And I think there will be more to come in this space, even as we're focusing so much on the coronavirus.
Yeah, and as that's going on the FISA front, we have other news around the intelligence community, including the firing of Michael Atkinson, who's the Inspector General for the intelligence community.
Was the Inspector General for the intelligence community.
As you recall, he was the one who notified Congress about the whistleblower that then ultimately led to the impeachment proceedings, and he got fired by the president and was criticized by the president. And then, of course, there have been other firings in the intelligence community, including two directors of national intelligence and others. And a lot of talk about those firings. And look, we have to say that the president has the authority to fire officials in the intelligence community. That's his prerogative. But these firings have spawned some concern out there about what they might mean for the intelligence community going forward.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the biggest issue here is if you just look at Michael Atkinson, who is, you know, a former prosecutor. He worked in the office you and I worked in. I didn't know him.
I know him well. And he's a tremendous public servant. And the guy is a straight arrow, straight as they come, and harder workers you're going to find, and completely committed to the rule of law.
I think the thing that is concerning people, including bipartisan members of Congress, with this firing is that he appears to have been fired not for cause, as they say, for abusing his role, but for actually doing his job. You know, that's a real concern for the intelligence community writ broadly. The intelligence community has a duty in it and has long adhered to a focus on speaking truth to power, as we say, right? I mean, to be very clear about the intelligence that they're gathering, what the potential implications are for the United States and its operations around the world, and to basically give it to policymakers without putting spin on the ball. And if there is this sense that you can be fired for just doing your job, what does that mean for that role of speaking truth to power going forward?
And I think that's the point here. It's not to take issue with any particular personnel decision. The president has the prerogative to decide who's in these various positions. It's the repercussions for the intelligence community, which, as you say, unlike really any other part of the government, has to feel like it can call strikes and balls with the intelligence without concern that there'll be personal consequences or professional consequences for doing that. And that's a tough thing, right? Because look, the reality is the national security intelligence world and the political world rub up against each other all the time. And that's always a tension. But people look to indicia like these kind of personnel moves in the government as evidence of whether politics is being paramount over the objective national security analysis or vice versa. And so I think that's the concern here. And I think we'll probably see more of this going forward.
I hope you enjoyed this bonus clip of Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. Thank you for becoming a part of the Insider community.